While I begin, Star Banks, who worked with us on this accreditation crosswalk, is going to pass out copies for you all. And I will let you know that this is hot off the press. You are the first people to have a physical copy of this crosswalk. And so for those of you who would like to look at it now and then decide you have absolutely no intention of taking it home because you can't fit it in your suitcase, if you could leave it, I will be identifying in the presentation exactly where you can get a copy when you get back home via a website. So please, if you are interested in taking it with you, more than happy to have you do so. If not, we'll use it in some other sessions as well. So I'm really pleased to have the opportunity to talk with you all today about a crosswalk that's actually been about 3.5 years in the making, trying to bring a couple of disparate programs together that have served the same purpose. I heard this in a presentation yesterday, and I just couldn't wait to do it myself. I have no relationships to disclose except that I've been married to my husband for 17 years, which I... And very happily so. And so I think most of you have already seen the three learning objectives that I have that first want to talk about the development of the crosswalk tool and who was involved in that development and identify exactly what the tool involves, then identify the types of connections between the community guide and the Public Health Accreditation Board standards, domains, measures, and standards, and finally give you a couple of practical suggestions for use. Very glad to see how many people are here from health departments. Some of you I hear have gone through accreditation process, and so once again, as you look through this today and in the future, we're very interested in your thoughts. So what is this crosswalk exactly? Well, this is a tool that actually provides a comprehensive crosswalk between the evidence-based interventions that are found in the Guide to Community Preventive Services, or the Community Guide for short, and all of the Public Health Accreditation Board standards and measures. What is its purpose? Why did we do this? Well, the intent really was to assist health departments that were in process of either thinking about accreditation or going through the process to figure out which evidence-based programs, services, and policies from the guide could actually help them demonstrate conformity with their standards and measures. And so because of this, there actually are two different things that can be of value to health departments. The first is that as they're looking at evidence-based interventions that might be associated with domain standards and measures, they may be able to secure documentation that can be used to strengthen their accreditation applications. And the second thing, to use the twofer term that Liza talked about earlier, is in doing so and looking at things that are available in the guide, they may actually be able to increase their use of evidence-based practices or take things that they are doing in their communities that are close to evidence-based and figure out what they can do to refine them and then identify that they're evidence-based. So this term evidence-based that gets bantered and thrown around a lot these days, what exactly is the value of using evidence-based processes? And let's start by talking about what is evidence in the first place. And so lots of definitions, but Ross Brownson's book on evidence-based public health that many of you may be familiar with talks about evidence as an available body of facts or information that indicate whether a belief that someone holds is actually true or valid. And there are a number of different sources of evidence that we go to in public health. And in general, one can go and talk to friends and say, hey, what worked in your jurisdiction? And that can be done through word of mouth. One of the challenges with word of mouth can be that if your jurisdiction is not exactly like another jurisdiction, something that worked one place may or may not work the same in another location, may need adaptation, or may actually have a need for something else altogether. Program evaluation is something that provides more refined information, and you can also get refined information from a research study. That this can also provide really good information that has some control for what is going on within a particular setting, but may or may not apply in different settings. And so this is why a number of groups do systematic reviews. And this is where we pull together multiple information from different sources to try to figure out across all of the different things or all of the different places that might, say, use an intervention, do they find it to be effective across all these different settings and situations? And you'll note that I've identified that there are research studies and program evaluations. That is when we talk about the community guide, we actually use both of those as sources. This is not just research studies, but we have at least half of the work that we do is looking at evaluation in real-world settings. And that's really important because we are not interested just in research studies, but also practice-based evidence, because that is what is often most applicable in the real world. So why would one use an evidence-based approach in a particular health department or for a community? And that can be because by using things that have already been identified as having evidence of effectiveness across a number of settings and situations, that can really help you to figure out where you're going to use scarce resources. And it can shorten the time it takes to actually develop a program or policy by knowing what interventions are effective and then being able to adapt as appropriate for your own community. And as the same FOA that was talked about by Liza earlier for the CDCs is one of the many applications now that is requiring the use of evidence-based approaches. So how does the community guide fit into all of this? And I noticed that a number of you put up your hand earlier. Who does not know about the community guide or has sort of a limited amount of information about the guide? All right, I'm seeing a few people brave enough to put up their hands, so I will make sure that I give that information. So where first does the community guide fit? Well, if you look at a typical planning model, of which there are many variations, the typical one would be looking at assessment, either through a community health needs assessment or something else, and then looking at your objectives, often set by a community, but Healthy People 2020 might also provide where you go, and then selecting interventions. What would actually work to meet those needs in a community and allow you to attain your objectives? That's where the community guide fits. And I have also highlighted the implementation area. As the community guide moves forward, we are actually bringing a lot of work into our website and into our actual work in technical assistance in helping people figure out how to actually implement things, select things and implement them that work in their own communities. And then, of course, the last stage is evaluation, and there are tools from the guide that help with evaluation as well. So what exactly is the guide? Well, the guide is basically two things. First, it is a series of systematic reviews that look at the effectiveness of programs, services, and policies that are typically delivered at a community level or a population level. The systematic reviews of the community guide also look for all interventions for which effectiveness is established. We also look at the economic benefit of those programs. So are they cost-effective? Is there good return on investment, cost benefit, and most importantly for most areas is just how much they cost, which can be really important, doesn't matter how cost effective if one doesn't have money in the first place. And then finally, we highlight critical evidence gaps that can be filled either by research studies or by evaluation, and so really encourage evaluators to look at those. And these reviews are used by the Community Preventive Services Task Force to come up with evidence-based recommendations and findings. So who is this task force? It's really important to note that although I am from CDC, I am mandated by Congress to provide, and my staff, scientific, technical, and administrative support for the task force. The task force itself is independent and non-federal. It is not the government at all, and the purpose of that is so that they can look at the evidence and they can come up with recommendations based on science, not based on a political process. And so then CDC, other federal agencies, just like states and locals, can look at the interventions that have been identified as effective by the guide and select those that really truly meet their needs. And it's all of the members also, to maintain this independence, serve without any compensation at all. Save at least 20 to 25% of their time completely free of charge. And there are a lot of really superb people on that task force that have evident involvement in policy and practice as well as research. This is not people who are just researchers. So the task force looks at four different areas of community preventive services. The first is informational and educational interventions, like the effectiveness of mass media campaigns for stopping people from alcohol-impaired driving. Is that really effective or not? They also, or we look at behavioral and social interventions, such things as there are different kinds of things like abstinence education, or comprehensive risk reduction strategies. Do those actually work in reducing risky sexual behavior, STIs, and pregnancy among youth? The last two areas that the task force looks at are environmental and policy interventions, like smoking bans and restrictions and whether they help with reducing environmental tobacco smoke, and then health system interventions that might bring people to the point of service by a clinician. So what's the effectiveness of client reminder and recall or provider assessment and feedback for various diseases and conditions? To date, we have about 225 findings that the task force has come up with. And just to put this in perspective, we are working our way through. We are mandated by Congress to update our reviews every 5 years, as well as do new ones. And we have identified that the universe of interventions that we would need to establish to fully look at our scope is about 800. So we have a ways to go yet, and we balance our resources between the updates that we are mandated to do, and indeed we need to do, so that the interventions remain, or the recommendations remain current, and looking at new areas as well. One of the things that I just want to highlight very quickly on one slide, which is really important, the Community Guide is unlike some other review groups, and we work very closely with Cochrane and Campbell and many of the other groups that you may be aware of, like the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. But our group is fairly unique in that all of our reviews are actually done by teams of people that include people who sit in state health departments, local health departments, liaisons from groups like ASTO, NACHO, NALBO, and others, and also health organizations. Our worksite reviews, as an example, had a VP from Coca-Cola and union members sitting with us looking at the evidence. And this is really important. We have liaisons that advise the task force at all stages of what they do, and then these people on the individual systematic reviews. And this is important because the task force isn't supposed to just say, does an intervention work? Yes, no. But how well, for whom, under what circumstances, cost, do they actually have value? Is there barriers? Are there any harms and unanticipated outcomes? And also, what are considerations for implementation? We couldn't do this very well if we did not have people from the field actually participating with us on these teams. The task force actually has a number of options. They can recommend an intervention on the basis of strong or sufficient evidence, recommend against the same way, or they can come up with a recommend or a current finding that at the current time there is insufficient evidence to recommend for or against. This is an important finding. This does not mean don't do. It just means at the current time there is not enough evidence to recommend for or against. And when people from a jurisdiction look at this, they may say, well, there isn't something else that meets my needs, so I'm going to look at this, but I better evaluate it to see whether it really is having the intended effect. And then if any of you happen to publish those evaluations, they then become available to us for the next time that we look at those interventions. Or you might choose to do something else for which there is more evidence. So now with this background on the guide, let me turn back to how we have linked it to the public health accreditation standards. Well, I want to begin by talking about the collaborative undertaking that we had to put this together. This was first undertaken through a cooperative agreement with a number of partners, of which NACHO was one of our partners. The people who worked on this, who are not here today, for those of you who know Pooja, Verma, Jessica, Fisher, who some of you may connect with in some of your work, you can certainly talk to them at any time about this. But I think Stephen from NACHO was going to possibly be here today. Yes, no, maybe? Okay. They worked very, very closely with the Community Guide branch at CDC, and then also with Liza, who's in the OD of the Ostiltz area, and then also people from the Division of Public Health Improvement. And what we attempted to do was to actually take all of the recommendations in the guide and to look at them and their intent and see how well that matched up with the intent and the requirements of the FAB standards and measures. By doing this, we identified that there were three different types of connections that could be made between the evidence-based interventions in the guide and the FAB domain standards and measures. And the first we describe as a direct relationship. And that is where the intent of the community guide intervention aligns quite closely with the intent of the FAB domain standard and measure, and where the aim or main components of the intervention are mentioned in the purpose and in the guidance information for the FAB measure. As a result of this aligning of intent, it's very likely that if a public health department is doing this intervention and it is able to collect documentation on that, then this documentation may be very helpful for FAB, because the documentation is a typical part of carrying out the intervention. Or, and this is very important, it illustrates, it's a good illustration of other things that the health department has in place, because in many areas FAB is asking for something that's an illustration of not just a one-time, but the way that things are approached across the health department. The second type of connection that we identified was what we would call an indirect relationship. And that is where, when you look at the intervention and you look at the FAB measure, they are not completely aligned, but the intent of the FAB measure may be addressed in the way that particular health departments carry out interventions. So it's very important in these cases to identify, is this the intent of the FAB measure being carried out in the way that your health department is particularly delivering the intervention? And if that's the case, then it may help you with documentation. The third relates to four FAB measures for which we encourage health departments to look at all of the community guide interventions. Two of these are measures that actually cite the community guide as a source of evidence-based interventions in the documentation. And then two more measures that are related to performance management and quality improvement. There are many things from the guide that actually help people set performance goals and measures. We have analytic frameworks and logic models that for all of our reviews that say this is how this population who gets this intervention could actually have this health outcome, and these are all of the other things we think could actually help or get in the way. Many people actually find these very, very helpful when they are setting up their program evaluations. And just as an FYI for people who go to look for these online, some of you may have heard about this thing called 508 compliance that the government is required to follow, and that is that all of the things on our websites have to be able to be read and understood by people irrespective of whatever disability they have. So many of our big documents had to be taken down and made readable in many formats, and they're being put back on over time. So if you ever go and don't find something, please contact us. The contact us site on the website is manned and looked at daily, and we can get back to you with that kind of information as well as other information that we have available. So I now want to walk you all through this document. And for those of you who have copies, I think most of you do, the very first thing that we have is a very lengthy overview and instructions for use. And that overview and the instructions, we encourage people to look at closely because of the fact that we really do want people to not just be picking and choosing, but doing things where there's really close alignment. In Table 1, we actually cross-reference the FAB domain standards and measures with interventions from the guide that can help. So if you look at, I'm going to be using one from Domain 5, but you can sort of look anywhere in Table 1. The very first thing that we have at the top of a page is the identification of the specific domain. And under that domain, we list a standard. So standard 5.1, which identifies and writes out in full the standard. Below that, we identify the specific measure that we are talking about on this table, or this portion of the table, 5.1.3a, if people are looking now. And then down the left-hand side, we identify the required documentation for FAB. Then on the right-hand side, we identify all of the interventions from the guide that relate to 5.1.3a and are consistent with what is required from documentation. Now, when you actually see the copy you have in front of you, these are underlined, which means that every single one of them is linkable directly to the page on the Community Guide website that actually has that task force, that information, the web intervention summary, the task force recommendation, and from there you can get other information. And for this and the intensity of this 90-page document, we thank Starbanks, sitting there, who obsessively made sure that everything was there and then made this entire thing 508 compliant, which was just a heroic effort.
Well, is she smiling?
Yes. She's smiling now. A couple days ago, I was pretty tight. And then the second table, many of you who are involved in accreditation preparation have to go speak to people in your health departments that are programmatic, have a programmatic background, and they don't really understand or haven't a lot of information about accreditation readiness. So this document is really to help you speak to the programmatic people. In this second table, we actually start with health topics, the community guide topics, and then identify the FAB measures that relate to those topics. And so if you look at any of the table two, the one that I'm looking at specifically is the physical activity page, and these are alphabetical, so you would just go to P. And here, table two starts with the topic listed at the top of the page. And then it identifies all of the domains for which there is a linkage with physical activity. And then below that, we actually identify all of the interventions from the guide down the left-hand side, and then on the right-hand side, identify the specific FAB measures and related documentation. And note that these are only pieces of the table, but that will give you an idea of how the tables are oriented. So where can you access the crosswalk, especially if you don't want to take it home? Well, the crosswalk was developed as an online tool. You can print it. There are PDF copies available, and eventually we are working on an HTML version as well. But it's almost 90 pages long, as you can see, and we want to keep it updated every time the task force comes up with new recommendations and when FAB updates its domain standards and measures. And so it will live on the Community Guide website. It is accessible from the main page, and there will be links to it from the NATCHO website and from the State, Tribal, Local, Territorial Professional Gateway on the OSTILTS portion of CDC's website. So where do the most connections occur? And I'll just go through this very loosely, just to give you an idea. You've already seen it in front of you all. It's really important to note that the connections change all the time. And so right now, there are connections in most of the FAB domains. And some of the measures relate to all of the community guide interventions, and those are identified here, domains 5, 9, and 10. Those are the broad, those have at least one measure that have a broad association, as we described earlier. Then when you look at discrete connections between a particular intervention and a particular measure, domains 3, 6, 7, 5, and 4 have the most direct connections and or indirect connections. Now, if we flip over to the other side and we look at topics, which are the topics from the community guide that have the most connections with FAB domains? And this is very helpful, again, for talking to people and identifying what are we doing in tobacco or vaccination or some other area that could actually really help us provide documentation for accreditation. These are the topics with the most connections. And the two topics that connect to the most domains are tobacco and vaccination. So I'm just going to end with a couple of things to keep in mind when you are actually considering using this crosswalk. For the first, many people will look at the title of an intervention and say, oh, we are doing that. But if they actually read the definition of the intervention and the task force recommendation, they might find that that's not really what they're doing. And so it is really important to read the title, the definition, and the task force statement, all of which you can link to very easily with this crosswalk, to make sure that what you're doing is actually something you can call an evidence-based approach recommended by the guide, and really importantly, so that you can expect to see similar results. It's very important. We have some work on behavioral interventions for reducing screen time, and a lot of people went, oh, I'm working on screen time. We have a pamphlet. That's not necessarily a behavioral intervention, but when people look at the behavioral intervention, what could be included, many health departments we've talked to have said, oh, I could do that. And then by adding those things, they actually then are doing an evidence-based intervention, and they're more likely to see the results that we are identifying. So this is really important. Two other quick things to keep in mind. As I hinted at earlier, we do not want people to just go through and pick one or two guide recommendations and say, gee, we can use that for our FAB documentation requirements. The most important thing that FAB is attempting to do is really to build capacity across health departments, and many things relate to processes. And so it's really important to identify interventions that are emblematic of what your health department is doing and then provide a really good example. So think carefully about which ones to use. And finally, the community guide has currently a broader scope than FAB does. We do things in the mental health area and some other areas that are currently beyond the FAB scope. And so one must think carefully if they are to use those examples for FAB. Really paying attention to the current scope of FAB is really important in determining your documentation. And I will end by saying that if you would like to access the crosswalk, again, it is at thecommunityguide.org. It's accessible from the main page. And as you attempt to use it, those of you who do, please provide us with input. The contact us site is maintained regularly and looked at daily. And also, you can talk to any of us, to Liza, to Star, or to me, and also to contacts at NHCHO. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, now do you believe that the group of programs that health departments operate have a link with accreditation? Say yes, because you heard three really good presentations. We have time now for questions and answers, dialogue with the panel. Wonderments, yeah.
Also, you get political pressure at the local level sometimes to do a particular thing, and these tools help kind of defend against that and shift back to something that's more effective. And so I wanted to thank all of you for the work that you do.
Yes.
One of the things that may be helpful, particularly when there's political pressure, one of the things that the Community Guide is doing at the current time is we are now congressionally mandated not just to do reviews and have the task force make recommendations, but actually to provide technical support to people in using them. And in addition to the people, of which they're limited, we are taking advantage of technology and building a decision and implementation support tool for individuals. And one of the things that tool will allow people to do as they go through and find interventions that may be helpful for them is to then download information about that tool toward their own, toward what they need themselves. So instead of a printout that's way too long to take to a legislator, for example, or you have 20 minutes to prepare something to go and speak to someone, you can tailor it to what would be most helpful to your situation. So we're in the process of that now. Probably will be by the end of the year that we'll have that information together. By the end of the fiscal year, not calendar year. I realize it's the end of year means different things to different people. But because of what you said, that's at least one part of some of the work that you do that may be able to be helped by having tailored information to give to people.
And now that we have accredited departments that have annual action, or annual reports that are due to work on things, this also is a resource for them. So
yeah.
Just those that haven't got accredited.
All right, great. Other questions? Yes.
This is a question actually for Kay.
Okay.
If you're taking questions. Yeah. I realize the N of accredited health departments is small, 20, but I'm wondering if you're seeing any themes yet in terms of which domains tend to be weaker across the board. And I would imagine that it goes to funding in some way, so I'm just curious if you
Not among the accredited health departments yet, but as you accurately stated, the N is small. But of the over 200 that are in process, and in speaking with ASTO and NHCHO and others who are working on technical assistance for applicants, health departments initially struggled with the prerequisites, with the CHA chip. Now, not all health departments, but that was a theme. A lot of that, it seems, is that once they understood what it was and that it was doable, we don't hear as much of that anymore, although there is one aspect to the Community Health Improvement Plan that is still a challenge for some health departments, and that is our emphasis on partnerships and community-driven. And depending on what the culture of the health department has been historically, that is a challenge for some health departments. In my own state, for example, that has a long history of being inside the walls of the health department doing direct services, now they're trying to both balance getting out of the health department walls and also getting those partners engaged in meaningful relationships to inform the CHIP. So that's been a challenge. We knew that Domain 9, just as you saw with the NIFI grantees, with quality improvement would be a challenge for everybody because it's new to public health. The good news is we have health departments that have done really well as we've asked them to tell us how you plan to do. And the trick will be sustaining that over time. Those have been the issues. I was interested to note from Andrea's data about the workforce development piece. Funding always affects that. And FAB has pretty, you know, high standards related to workforce development, and so we see a little bit of struggle with that. But it's way too early to say there are themes. Those are just really anecdotal pieces that that I can share with you there.
Well, I'll add that I think what we've seen through NIFI, and Andrea only shared a drop of it, so I, of course, know a little bit more about what's behind that. That's been very consistent with what we've also heard from ASTO and NACHO, even beyond the non-NIFI kind of TA requests and channels, that the Kay just mentioned Domain 8 with the workforce development, the need for a workforce development plan and to have updated job descriptions or position descriptions for all staff, that's been an area where a lot of health departments have had to put attention that has not necessarily been in place, obviously. Quality improvement, while there may have been quality improvement projects, having an agency-wide QI plan, agency-wide performance management system, obviously that's what's a little bit more behind Domain 9 than just doing a quality improvement or doing quality improvement projects or evaluation work. So I think the way that some of the standards were characterized is leading to also where there's perhaps the need to really think in a new and advanced way about what needs to be done in certain areas.
It's been interesting, just on a final comment about that, that health departments going through various stages of economic struggles and workforce struggles. Some have used accreditation, I would say, as the excuse, if you will, with their policymakers, their elected officials, their boards, whomever, to say, you know, down the road we want to be accredited. And so we're going to use the standards and measures to define who we're going to be on the other side of the economic downturn. And so some of even our early accredited health departments are those that have experienced some of the worst cuts that we've seen across the country. Others have been so affected by the cuts that they've pulled in a little bit more and thinking accreditation is going to be so expensive and so much work, they've kind of retreated from that. So it's been an interesting, that would be a study in and of itself to see that. The one thing that I would put the plug in that I would hope you guys would take back to your colleagues from today is that accreditation is not another program. And that's still sort of it's a culture we have in public health. NIFI is often seen as another program. When NIFI and FAB have in common that piece to strengthen the foundation upon which health departments work and the programs rest. And so it feels to me, I have no data, this is just Kay's opinion, but it feels to me like those health departments who get NIFI funding and or who are also working on accreditation have understood that this is not a program that is separately funded. They're going to manage a separate program, but it's a way of doing business. And once they sort of get that, then they use the TOOFERS, as Liza said, and the other information. Most health departments have the documentation. They may need to clean it up a little bit. They may need to present it in a little different way. But these crosswalks, I think, are going to be enormously helpful to help health departments to see. It's not a starting from scratch. You don't erase the board and reinvent your health department. It's a different way of thinking about it. I'd like, on that note, to put the accredited health department folks, and there are three of them that I know of in the room, on the spot and just say, were those comments or any you've heard today accurate? from the accreditation programmatic linkage perspective. Rex, I'm going to start with you because you're a board member and I know you've thought about this, but then Terry and April, I'm sorry, I just drew a blank. That's age, sorry. I'll go in that order. So Dr. Archer's from the Kansas City Health Department in Kansas City, Missouri. So
you're always right,
Rex. Yeah.
No, we get so silo-driven sometimes, and it's even more of a challenge the farther down we go in our organization. And this becomes that culture-changing, cross-cutting tool. Many of us that were involved with originally trying to get this process started or had state accreditation processes before FAB, not only found that culture shift in our own department, but we're able to use that to protect us from being cut. I've occasionally gone forward with elected officials and said, I need this resource for accreditation. And I'll just share with the group here, there is life after an action plan. When we went through our process as an accreditation group, FAB won't share where you are in the process. You're either in process or you're accredited, but I'll share that we didn't quite make the mark in the first process, and we had some areas that we needed to work on in our action plan. And to be honest, I've been struggling with getting my staff to do some of those things for a year or so, and then when I had the action plan, we got it done. So you can actually build your department and strengthen you, and sometimes it's better to be lucky and smart. So the fact that we got an action plan, I think actually made it stronger.
Terry, any comment?
Just very briefly, thank you. Here's where you probably are all right now. If one of the 248 pages of domains and standards, they call, and we're going to find a document. And everyone starts out from the way. And in our case, we had about a third of the documentation. We had some modified a little bit. Another third, we know what we were doing. We just had to shore up the proof that we were doing. Another third, it was clueless. I mean, we had absolutely no idea how to proceed. And what you see over time, and I think what you're going to experience over time, is not only are you gathering in your meetings and finding which documents you're going to pull together to meet the standard, but you're going to start to see, as Kate said, starting to build into the culture. You're going to see independent, believe it or not, performance management and quality improvement with your staff doing it. You never told them to do it. Same thing on the workforce, same thing on other aspects of it. And I think that's the important part of this whole process, because we're moving public health practice forward by laying out some, let's face it, stretch goals that maybe are a little tenuous right now to meet, but it's pushing us to improve our practice. And as more and more of you get involved with this, and suddenly we have a body of practice that we can go across. So, and I think it's going to continue with the next iteration of 1.5 and 2.0 and all the other future iterations. There's going to be a nudging of us to improve our public health practice. I think of everything, I think of accreditation, that's probably for me the best aspect of the entire process.
Thanks. April? Harris. I actually know your full name.
Documented. So I think that it's invaluable.
Thank you. Thanks, Arthur. Yeah, Rex.
One thing I didn't mention, we've gone through this process now. This is our third time, our first time at the national level, and twice at the state level. And each time, our employees made the pension type. Just, you know, the feeling of the accomplishment. But the thing that I'm most proud of is when we got nationally accredited, and I'm going through the department, thanking folks for their contribution, linking various things to how we move forward. And we had actually lost 50 positions back in 2002 and 2003, and got 40, 45 of those back in 2 to 3 years after we got accredited. And it was actually part of our strategy that helped us do that. But I'm walking through the building, and I'm talking to an employee and thanking her for her work, and she says, "Well, you know what? We recently submitted the action plan. We've already approved." And that tells you there's a shift, because this employee is actually one of the most resistant to any of this stuff, and putting something down in writing and all of that. And for her to just turn around and already bragging about how they had improved the process from what we had just recently submitted to get our action plan approved, was just, you know, yeah, my jaw was dropped to see the change.
So we'll wrap this up, but I want to make a couple of comments related to the work you hear today. I hope you also saw through this that CDC is doing a really good job of working with us, and hopefully we're doing a good job being a partner back, so that, as Liza said, to start with, our expectations of health departments are congruent, and that you're not finding a lack of synchronization between what your health department is doing related to a CDC program area and what FAB's expecting. Program areas are always going to go a little deeper. They need to. But hopefully at that overall health department level, we're in sync. And then when we do call out particular programmatic areas, such as those that relate to chronic disease or those that relate to emergency preparedness or environmental public health or whatever it is, that we're calling out a component of what the program has at the deeper dive level. Lastly, I want to say that we will spotlight information about the crosswalk in this month's newsletter. So for those of you who are signed up for that and need a little bit more about what you heard today, we'll be working with Shauna's office in order to get that done. So with that, thank you for coming, and let's thank our panelists for that.